Okay, are there any preliminary questions or issues? All righty. As I said, we'll hand out the outline tomorrow. I'll also post this outline, so if you're unable to make it to class tomorrow, you can download it off my off the website. Any other preliminary issues or questions? Okay, we left off on page 108 looking at Fine versus, or on the verge of looking at Fine versus Permanente, and as I said, it's illustrative of the effort to from the defendant's standpoint, strike a better balance between a kind of unlimited tort liability threatening the activities to which that tort liability is assigned, and at the same time trying to preserve the right of the plaintiff to receive adequate compensation. So how this is done, and then how it's regarded by the courts is something we'll see again actually in Chapter 7 when there's a provision relating to the statute of limitations that is challenged for constitutional or challenged on constitutional grounds. Another thing I might point out is that oftentimes the challenge is brought on the basis of a state constitutional provision as distinguished from a federal constitutional provision where the plaintiff believes that the judges will be more inclined to find a violation of a state constitutional provision, and it will insulate the decision, if it's favorable to the plaintiff, from review by the U.S. Supreme Court. If you base it on a an interpretation of the United States Constitution, that ultimately is the province of the U.S. Supreme Court, whereas if you say, for example, that a parallel state constitutional provision, which in this state means such and so, Supreme Court will say, well, fine, you know, if that's the way you run your state, that's your business. So, again, just a little window here. Somebody want to tell us about what happened in Fine and how the statute applied and how the constitutional challenges ran? Mr. Brett. So roughly, that's a total of about $800,000 in economic damages, and as you said earlier, $500,000 in non-economic pain and suffering damages. Okay? Or MICRA, as its acronym would suggest. And it is that statute, that tort reform provision that's being challenged by the plaintiffs. Tell me about the nature of the challenge. Why is this statute unconstitutional? Okay. So the first issue is whether or not this legislation violates equal protection. Second question is whether it violates due process. The third question is whether it violates the right to trial by jury. Each of these is obviously a constitutional guarantee, the first two being found in the 14th Amendment. No state may deprive any person of equal protection of the law or due process of law. But obviously, those restrictions on what states can do are fairly non-obvious in their application. Well, you know, what is equal protection of the law? What does that mean? So, again, we're not doing constitutional law here. Well, we are, but my focus is not to make you whizzes on this particular subject, but just to at least follow the argument here. What's the argument as to, first of all, tell me how the courts have interpreted the Equal Protection Clause, what it permits and what it forbids. Yes. Okay, so the first step in the analysis is to say a person claims to be treated unequally. You treated this person differently from the way you treated me. You discriminated against me. You gave me different treatment. And so the first step is to figure out, well, what kind of discrimination are we talking about? Because there's discrimination and then there's discrimination. It all depends on what the basis of the discrimination is or the category into which the discrimination falls. And as you say, there are these different levels of scrutiny apply to different kinds of discrimination. And it turns out, since this case the court has refined, there are now three tiers of scrutiny. But let's talk first about the way they explain the different kinds of discrimination and how we treat those. But what's the first one? Okay, it applies to things like race. It mentions sex here, but sex or gender turns out to occupy this middle level, intermediate scrutiny. So there's strict scrutiny and the so-called rational basis test at the ceiling and the floor, and in the middle, it turns out discrimination on the basis of sex or gender is subjected to this intermediate scrutiny. But at the most sensitive level would be things like race discrimination. So a statutory provision or an action of government of the state that makes distinctions, treats people differently because they belong to different race groups, is subjected to this strict scrutiny. It's possible to discriminate. In fact, that's sort of what affirmative action is all about. It is possible to say, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, we are going to treat people a little bit differently because of their race. That's permissible if you survive this strict scrutiny. There must be this compelling state interest that is narrowly tailored to the remedy that you seek. Then it's okay. But again, you have to pass through this very sort of the pass through the eye of a needle here in terms of being able to convince the court there is this absolutely compelling state interest, and we've done the best we can to avoid this, but there's no other way except to set up different categories to say you get treated this way if you belong to this racial group, and you get treated that way if you belong to that racial group. Now, again, it turns out there's this intermediate scrutiny applied to sex discrimination. So the big case on this in the relatively recent past was the Virginia Military Institute. when the Virginia Military Institute, a state-operated institution, said, we're going to have a military institute, but it's only for men. No women need apply. We have a separate, we have a military institute for women, you know, but, and if you want to do that, you can go there, but if, but VMI is reserved for men. And women who wanted to get into VMI said, well, gee, you know, this is the place from which serious military careers are made. If you go to the women's place, you just don't get anywhere. That's the reality. So we want to be, we challenge this discrimination against us. And the standard for that intermediate scrutiny is that there has to be a strong governmental interest that is closely related to the means sought. Again, it's this, you know, kind of middle thing. It's neither the eye of a needle strict scrutiny, nor is it this rational basis test at the bottom. It is you have to have an important reason, and you have to show that the means you've chosen bear a strong relationship to this interest. And so the state of Virginia tried to explain why it was so important to restrict VMI to men, and the Supreme Court did not find their reasons persuasive. Majority of the court said, you simply haven't given us a good enough reason why you won't let women in. And so again, that's intermediate scrutiny. Now, at the lowest level here is discrimination on the basis of okay, and in what respect is Mr. Fine a victim of discrimination? But how is he being treated unequally? Who's getting better treatment than he is? Like? Yeah, if doctors, you know, if somebody from the defendant's medical group had hit him in an intersection, there'd be no limit on his pain and suffering recovery. But because the tort injury occurred in a doctor's office and it comes under the heading of medical malpractice, he's limited in his right to recover. So there is some discrimination here, but again, this falls within the category of saying trucks over 10,000 gross vehicular weight, you know, are subject to this kind of tax and, you know, have to have these kinds of, you know, and so forth and so on. Lots and lots and lots of things the government does set up different rules and apply, you know, if you fall in this category, you get treated one way. If you fall into that category, you get treated another way. But if you don't fall, if the form of discrimination has nothing to do with race or ethnicity or, you know, religion or some other protected category, and it doesn't fall within the area of gender, then government is free to discriminate, to say people with trucks over 10,000 pounds have to do this, but you don't have to do it. People who employ more than 8 people, blah, 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 et cetera. All of that is subject to this rational basis test. And what's the test there? Some conceivable basis. Again, it's not that the statute articulates this. You know, it is not necessary for the statute to justify itself. All you have to do is have some conceivable state purpose in order to, and then you just have to show it has a rational relationship. The court makes it very clear that it is not the court's function to decide that it's persuasive, that this is a good enough reason, that the arguments in favor of this legislation are better than the arguments against this legislation. That, says the court, is for the legislature. All we have to do is find out that there is a rational basis, whether we agree with it or not. What is the rational basis for limiting this guy's recovery to $250,000? Okay, what's the plaintiff's answer to this claim that this legislation was necessary to avert a crisis in healthcare? This had nothing to do with the crisis, said the plaintiff. What really was going on, or this so-called crisis, has nothing to do with the tort system. What's really going on, says the plaintiff, is that as the economy made the insurance investments less profitable, they jacked up the premiums to compensate not for higher tort recoveries, but for lower yield in the investments they were able to make. So when the economy is in a growth mode, you take premiums at the low end, you pay out 5 years later, because that it takes that long for the claim to work its way through the system, and by the time you have to pay out, you've taken your money and doubled it, or you can take a modest premium and still make a profit paying out after you've made all this money on your investment. By contrast, when the economy goes flat or even down, I got to charge a much higher premium because I can't double my money. And this is a cyclical phenomenon, so that what insurance rates did go up. You're right. But why did they go up? Not because plaintiffs are getting these killer awards. It's because the insurance companies are not making as much money as they want. That's why we have this crisis. What does the court say to that argument? Is the plaintiff wrong? Exactly. What is talk to the hand, because the what's that line from Mike Myers or whatever it is? Anybody remember? Anyway, it's essentially the court says, in effect, we're not in the business of evaluating. You may be perfectly correct, plaintiff, and if I were in the legislature, I would agree with you that this legislation is stupid, counterproductive, etc. It's unfair, what have you. But you know what? I'm not in the legislature. I'm a judge. I can't do that. I can't second guess what they say. Now, again, the name of the game here is classification. Classify this as something that falls within this rational basis test, and you have the most minimal burden as a plaintiff to succeed. You don't have the minimal burden as a plaintiff. You have a minimal burden as the person defending the constitutionality of the statute to show a rational relationship. Now, it is true that courts do sometimes fail to find even a rational relationship. And in fact, in a number of the gay rights cases, the Colorado Initiative case, Initiative 2, I think it was in Colorado, that was struck down, and I think in the Massachusetts case, the gay marriage case, in both those instances, I believe the court said, you haven't even given us a rational, there is no rational relationship between the legislation and the asserted interests of the state. So it's not that courts never strike things down by finding that there's no rational relationship, but it's a pretty tough standard for the challenger to meet. The better way to play the game from the standpoint of somebody challenging legislation on the basis of equal protection is to get yourself into a better class, you know, to say that that the interest that you represent is a more fundamental one. So again, in the gay rights cases, one of the questions has been, does limiting legislation fall within some kind of restriction on a fundamental liberty that would require the state to produce a much more compelling kind of reason than the limited kind of reason that would satisfy a rational basis test. So again, that's the way the Equal Protection Clause challenges have been made, and as you'll see when you get to actually studying these cases in depth in constitutional law, the body of law about equal protection challenges is enormous. I mean, there's just a lot of litigation, and in particular, when you get into things like gender discrimination, where it's this kind of middle position, it's really hard to evaluate, well, what is a strong governmental interest and what is something that's closely related, you know, fairly indistinct boundaries here, to be able to predict with some confidence, oh, this one will be upheld as constitutional, this one will be struck down. So, again, you will have more opportunity later on in your law school career to look at it in depth. Here, the plaintiff was unable to persuade the court that there was any discrimination that triggered higher scrutiny. It was down at this bottom level. The court said, you know, they got a rational basis. I may or may not agree with it, but it's rational. Okay, so that one failed. Tell me about the due process clause. So what does the due process clause prohibit? What is it you can't do? Yes. Yes. So you can't, in particular here, we're not talking about life or liberty, we're talking about property. You can't take away their property without due process of law. So all of you may think it's a great idea to build a freeway that cuts through my backyard, but you can't take that away from me unless you go through some kind of due process. And in fact, if you take away my property, you've got to compensate me for it. What is his property interest that has been taken away, he claims? My right to compensation. He says, I had, you know, this person negligently treated me. That gives rise to a right to compensation, and that right was, you know, cut off, limited, in the same way that somebody says, hey, we want the back 20 feet of your property so we can build a freeway through here. And if you have to provide due process before you can take that away, why wouldn't you have to go through due process before you take away my right to compensation? That's his argument. What's the court's response? Ah, so you don't really have a property right in any kind of compensation, at least for a tort injury. The legislature giveth and the legislature taketh away. Blessed be the name of the legislature with regard to this stuff. They can create a cause of action. They can take it away. You can't claim that this is something that inheres in your, it belongs to you. It's a creature of statute, or at least of statutory tolerance. So we could decide, for example, all this tort litigation, you know, just makes people crazy. We're not going to have any more tort suits anymore. We've just abolished all tort litigation. That would be kind of a dumb idea, it would seem. But notice we did that, for example, with workers' comp. In one area of our society, the relationship between employer and employee, we decided that the tort system didn't work very well. And we abolished the tort cause of action, replaced it with a system of compensation for injuries on the job. We could do that with all injuries, automobile injuries, medical injuries, product liability injuries, slip and fall. We could just say, when you get injured through somebody's negligence, or for that matter, if you get injured, period, we have a social fund set up that provides compensation, but don't go around suing people. Now, again, is that a smart idea, a dumb idea? Not for the courts to decide, says the court. If the legislature believes that our society would be better off by creating a new cause of action for disposal of hazardous wastes or introducing some cause of action for whatever, the legislature's free to do that or get rid of it. Defamation or invasion of privacy or stealing people's trade secrets or, again, I think we talked before about the idea of alienation of affections. Once upon a time, it was a tort to interfere with someone else's, you know, marriage or intimate relations. And if you intentionally broke up somebody's relationship, they could sue you for that. And then people said, no, that's crazy. Doesn't make any sense. Bad social policy. And so that cause of action was abolished. So again, the court is saying this is not something that was inherent in your existence as a human being from the time you came into this world. This is something which the legislature has historically provided for or tolerated, and when the legislature gets sick of it, they can take it away, and you have no complaint in terms of saying, you took away my rights. Okay, final question. What about the right to trial by jury? Yeah. This one's a little tricky because the plaintiff's argument on the one hand proves too much and too little at the same time. Let's suppose the legislature says we don't want, they modify the hearsay rule or they have some different provision in how economic damages are calculated. Well, I mean, the jury is supposed to provide the law. The jury is supposed to follow the law. The jury can't essentially make up their own rules. If something is hearsay and inadmissible, the jury has to live with that. If this jurisdiction awards punitive damages or doesn't award punitive damages, well, that's the law in this jurisdiction. At the same time, if the right to trial by jury is all formality, so that, for example, we impanel a jury to decide whether the plaintiff or the defendant has better taste in clothing, and we ask the jury to render their verdict, and at the end of their deliberations they say, we find that the plaintiff is better dressed than the defendant, but that's the only role that they play. Meanwhile, the judge goes back and decides all the questions about the measure of damages and so forth. We would say, well, wait a minute, it's not just the pomp and circumstance of having the jury there, it's that the jury plays a meaningful role in deciding what the outcome is, whether there's liability, what the measure of damages is. So could the court, in effect, reduce the jury to, you know, window dressing, not having any role on damages? At what point would it cross over from being simply a modification of the law by which the jury is bound, as much as they would be by rules of evidence or procedure or what have you? And at what point does the right to trial by jury require some kind of meaningful role? We don't really know the answer to that question. But this one's at least on the modest side. The court doesn't even spend much time on it, as you point out. There was a trial. The jury did decide liability. The jury did award damages. But they have to follow what the law is. So if the law says, here's the standard for awarding lost profits, or here's the way you measure damages in an invasion of privacy case, the jury can't simply say, well, we have our own ideas about that. Take your instructions and shove them. We're going to do what we please. Well, that can hardly be, you know, no one would say that's what the trial by jury, right to trial by jury means. But again, where the logic fails on that is no one really knows. Yeah. Yes, because this is another complaint about the right to trial by jury. I think I make reference to a Washington statute which tried to reduce or limit the award of pain and suffering damages, and the Washington Supreme Court struck that statute down as a violation of the right to trial by jury. In fact, again, they pointed to a state constitutional provision in which it said that the right to trial by jury shall remain inviolate, which doesn't mean they all have to wear purple clothes. It means that, again, there's something sort of sacred about the jury. Now, you could say, for example, that we instruct the jury that the most you can award in non-economic damages is $250,000. You give them the law, but there's something kind of crummy. If you say the right to trial by jury shall remain inviolate, it's kind of crummy to tell the jury, make your award of damages, and then later on we take our scissors, you know, and modify it. Maybe, particularly if your state constitutional provision adds a kind of emphasis to the right to trial by jury, maybe the least you have to do is tell the jury what the law is. But to sort of give them the impression we're letting you do what you want, but then we take it back later on, that is dishonoring them in a way, disrespecting them. So, again, how you balance these things is not entirely clear. And different courts have gone different ways. Later on, there's a fourth constitutional argument. Many state constitutions have something in them that say the right of the people to seek redress in the courts shall forever remain open to the people for the redress of grievances. It's this sort of open courts idea. And when you have things like statutes of limitation or statutes of repose that limit a person's ability to file a claim, some people have said, well, wait a minute, there's a guarantee that I can seek redress, and what you've imposed this barrier to me, and the Constitution prevents the legislature from setting up those kinds of artificial barriers. So again, figuring out at what point the legislature is doing a reasonable kind of modification of the law, and at what point the legislature has infringed upon some area of rights guaranteed by the Constitution, this is still pretty sloppy. It varies from state to state and how the Supreme Court has read these, you know, again, in the Washington Constitution and lots of other state constitutions, you have these things drafted in, you know, 1885 or whatever it is on the back of an envelope, in effect. You know, people write out this stuff. It's sort of, you know, nice-sounding prose. They adopt it. Everybody forgets about it. You know, they rediscover it in 1978. Oh, wow, you know, look at this. And suddenly you start interpreting it and applying it, you can get some fairly interesting stuff coming out of it where the judges say, the legislature has certain prerogatives, but they can't do this. And some people say, yeah, that's great. And some people say, this is judicial activism or, again, the tug of war between what goes on in the courts and what goes on in the legislature. Okay, so again, just a kind of vignette here of the way this law works, the kind of political dynamics in which typically the manufacturing or defense insurance interests, which tend to be concentrated and have, you know, good political clout, they have an influence in the legislature. They are offset by consumer groups, trial lawyers groups, other forces trying to preserve the personal injury system. And trial lawyers of late have gotten more and more politically savvy and politically powerful, so that they're relatively evenly balanced. But if you get something that's really driving, for example, medical groups or other, manufacturers or insurance companies, where they think they can ride political sentiment and get something enacted by way of tort reform, a lot of this stuff has percolated through state legislatures. We'll see it again in Chapter 6 in response to the joint and several liability issue, where the rules about when defendants have to pay more than their individual share, they have to pay the plaintiff's full damages because some other defendant can't pay, and so the defendant is told, in effect, you've got to cover for your missing co-defendant. Many states have re-examined that and said, we don't like the traditional rule that says defendants are liable for the entire injury regardless of their individual share of fault. We want to limit their liability to what the jury assigns them in terms of the percentage, the allocation of overall assessment of fault. And again, we'll see that in Chapter 6 in the form of statutes that adopt different rules. And a lot of those have been influenced by defense groups who say, it isn't fair that we're found to be 10% at fault and we have to pay 100% of somebody's injury just because there was a drunk driver involved who didn't have insurance and obliterated the plaintiff. So, again, we'll come back to a lot of this whole sort of tort reform idea, but this is kind of a little foretaste of it. Schoenberger versus Roberts, our next case, is a similar kind of problem. We can at least get started with it here, and might need to finish it up tomorrow. But can somebody tell us about Schoenberger versus Roberts? Here again, we have a workers' compensation angle. Yes, go ahead. Yeah, and let me just say there is a parallel between the issues of whether somebody's in the course and scope of employment for purposes of collecting workers' comp, that's where the employee wants to be in the course and scope of employment, and the issue in vicarious liability about whether somebody's in the course and scope of employment. They're not exactly the same body of law because they're for different purposes here. One is to determine, is this something for which the workers' compensation program is on the hook? The other is, can we fairly impute the employee's action to the employer? But again, there's oftentimes a kind of similarity between the idea of whether you're really on the job or you're really on some kind of personal business that doesn't implicate the employer or the workers' comp. But this guy clearly was doing the employer's work, gets hurt, sues the defendant, and what's the issue in the case? Okay, and the issue is the effect of the so-called collateral source rule. Tell me what the collateral source rule is. Actually, before you get to the statute, there's a more general kind of, when people use that term, referring to the collateral source rule, what do they mean? Actually, you can. The point of the collateral source rule is to say that's not double dipping. So historically at common law, when the question first arose, and here's the scenario, just as in this case, the plaintiff is suing the defendant. The plaintiff wants the defendant to compensate the plaintiff, but the plaintiff is already getting money from workers' comp or some other third party, an insurance plan, a disability plan, some other source of compensation, and the defendant says, well, I don't have to pay the plaintiff's full damages. He's already got a bunch of money from somebody else. So again, suppose the plaintiff's house is burned down. It's Vaughn versus Menlove. Defendant has burned down the plaintiff's house, and the defendant says, ah, but your fire insurance policy paid you your damages. I don't need to compensate you. The collateral source rule said what? The common law rule, when this question first arose, the court said, oh, yes, you do. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. Go ahead and pay the plaintiff as though he never got any other compensation except what the defendant was going to provide. Now, we refer to it as a collateral source because we want to distinguish it from another defendant. So let's say there's another defendant, like in an asbestos case, I've settled with a bunch of defendants, and now I want some defendant who's refused to settle with me, I want to now collect the balance of my damages. If I've already collected money from other defendants, that's not considered a collateral source. That has to be taken out. And again, in Chapter 6, we look at the effect of settlement and all the different permutations on that problem. But when we refer to a collateral source, we're talking about something unrelated to the defendant's liability. It's something like an insurance policy, like the fire insurance case that you would have in Vaughn versus Menlove. What was the rationale behind the collateral source rule? Why is it that courts said, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain, the fact that the plaintiff's getting compensated elsewhere? What sense did it make to permit this apparent double dipping? It did make sense. We just need to identify what that reason was. Can anybody think of a good, if you were the plaintiff's advocate, Ms. Johnson? Okay, one idea, going back to Vaughn versus Menlove, if I've been paying my fire insurance, and sure enough, my fire insurance company pays me to rebuild my house, and the defendant who caused this injury said, hey, you know, no harm, no foul. You would say, wait a minute, that's crazy. He ought to pay in proportion to the harm that he's caused, or otherwise he'd sort of get away with something. But there's another reason why it may not turn out to be double dipping. Go ahead. Yes. And in addition, if you read your insurance policy carefully, you will find something in that policy that addresses cases just like this. It's called a subrogation clause. It says, in effect, if you are entitled to a recovery from somebody else to compensate you for this loss that we are paying, we the insurance company, you've got to reimburse us. And it also says, for example, in a fire insurance policy, you have to help us go find that person. You have to cooperate, at least, in an effort for us to recoup from this negligent party the money we've had to pay out. So that's true in your health insurance policy. It's true in things like, you know, a car insurance or fire insurance, homeowners insurance. They will say in the policy, typically, they may, for some strange reason, have left it out, but typically they will say, we're going to pay you these benefits, but if you get compensation from somebody else, you've got to reimburse us. That way, it turns out there is no double dipping. The money goes back to the workers' comp fund. As Ms. Johnson was saying, we're trying to keep the workers' comp liability low, so that if the defendant is forced to pay, the workers' comp system will get recharged with this compensation and will take some strain off the system. Yeah. What the courts are saying is your fear of double dipping is misplaced, because in most situations, the recovering plaintiff will have to repay this third party. Now, it may not be true in all cases. For example, my Aunt Susan may write me a check that says, "Here, dear David, I hear you've been in this automobile accident. Here's $10,000 to pay your medical bills and get better. You know, I hope your recovery goes well." I don't have to repay Aunt Susan. I'm double dipping, but the court would say, again, if we have to choose between a windfall to the defendant or a windfall to the plaintiff, why should the plaintiff's paying of these premiums, or for that matter, Aunt Susan's generosity, go to the benefit of the defendant? Maybe there will be some double dipping, but if so, that's preferable to a general rule that says the defendant can reduce his liability by showing that the plaintiff is lucky enough or paid good money to obtain some kind of collateral compensation. Okay, that's the way we'll have to leave the story here for the moment. But the next chapter, we essentially got the background here of how the common law came to it, but this is another example of tort reform, of a statute designed to try to make the system better, at least so the legislature thought. And the question is, how do we now incorporate this statute into the system? But we'll pick that up tomorrow.